2023 is just doing nothing but just giving our data, our, both our personal like biometric data as well as our that's all we are. We're just data producing machines for larger entities.
And just for sale. That's it.
And our sole job is just to produce more data producing machines in the form of children. That's it. Right. Like that's what it comes down to.
Alert scores are generated after a user takes the app's alert monitor test, which is one of the watch's key features. Citizens suggest taking the alert monitor test daily. Wow. CZ smartwatches also track sleep. Citizen claims that software can determine whether you're a morning or evening person based on your chronotype. For determining a user's chronotype, the watchmaker crunches the wearer's sleep data and alert scores over a period of 7 to 10 days using IBM Watson Studio data from IBM's supercomputer.
The smartwatch also includes sensors that have become most common on most smartwatches, such as a gyroscope, accelerometer, barometer, altimeter, and blood oxygen monitor. Android and iOS phones can be used with the watches, which run on Google's Wear OS software.
Smartwatches like this can help keep track of health and healthy habits. For some people, this much data may be overwhelming, but for most users, it provides an objective peek into the well-being and habits of the user and can be useful in giving people the data that will enable them to make smarter health choices. Thanks for listening to Noise Filter, your public health podcast. Stay well out there, folks, and continue taking steps to keep yourself and your loved ones healthy. That includes exercise, a good diet, getting adequate sleep, and seeing your healthcare providers regularly.
And protect yourself and others by getting the COVID-19 vaccine and booster, wearing a mask, and social distancing wherever possible. Remember, health is a human right.
To KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
These are the final days of KBOO's Volume 2 All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign, wrapping up with a full day of live music. Saturday, March 25th, KBOO's annual Bluegrass Marathon will be held at the historic Multnomah Grange 71 in Gresham. Go to kboo.fm/bluegrass23 for ticket info. Tune in or join us in person for the 2023 Bluegrass Marathon on March 25th and get your exclusive limited edition 2023 Bluegrass Marathon t-shirt at kboo.fm/bgshirt.
On the next all-new Voices for the Animals, it's part one of our coverage of the crisis at the Multnomah County Animal Shelter. We'll be speaking with two veteran volunteers who will tell us about their experiences and why they felt the need to speak out so strongly.
We've got to see improvement. We've got to see changes. We've been trying to get people's attention about this for years, and I think people just never really understood what was going on out there.
If you love animals and are especially concerned about the welfare of our community's pets, please join us for the next edition of Voices for the Animals, Friday, March 24th at 10 a.m. right here on 90.7 KBOO FM.
Welcome to Labor Radio on KBOO Portland. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilland.
Thank you so much for joining us. We would first just like to give a special thanks and shout out to the Labor Radio Podcast Network for hosting podcasted versions of our show each month. Be sure to check that out at laborradionetwork.org. And before we get started, I want to let you all know that KBOO is coming to the end of our All Thrills, No Frills winter membership drive. Don't forget that KBOO is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by amazing people like you. In fact, 80% of the station's funding comes from the generosity of our members. If you can, please help us reach our goal of raising $17,000. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. We here at Labor Radio thank you so much for your support. Now, today we're going to discuss a series of legislative developments that are a cause for excitement within the labor movement. We'll begin first in the American Midwest, where last week, just over a decade after union members and labor advocates from across the United States rallied at the Michigan State Capitol to protest the state Republicans' passage of the so-called right to work law, many of the same people were present in Lansing as the Democrat-led state Senate voted to end what one lawmaker called the failed experiment of gutting Michigan workers' rights. With a 20-17 vote that came down along party lines, a package of bills was passed that will repeal the anti-worker legislation. Included in this is $1 million in appropriations to inform employers, employees, and labor organizations about changes to their rights and responsibilities.
The appropriations make this legislation referendum-proof, meaning opponents would need to gather more than 446,000 signatures to propose a constitutional amendment restoring the right to work on the ballot in 2024.
Yeah, so all that's left now is for Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer to sign it into law, which she's given strong indications that she intends to do. In fact, her office released a statement applauding the House and Senate for voting in favor of the bill and saying, quote, "Working people should always have basic freedoms in the workplace without interference from the government." And so right-to-work laws, as you know, you may or may not be aware, came to prominence during the Obama administration, during the Obama era, following the Supreme Court's victory of Citizens United, which, you know, if you are living under a rock or just not paying attention to politics, basically allows money to enter politics by saying that corporations are the same as individuals and so that they can donate politically the same way that individuals can. And so Right to Work was actually a product of the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, which is a Koch brother-funded right-wing conference that brings together politicians and corporate lobbyists to promote public policy items that overwhelmingly benefit big business. The basic premise of this organization is that corporate lobbyists craft boilerplate pieces of legislation that benefit their clients, which their elected partners then take back to their state houses and pass into law. You might be familiar with some of their other legislative hits, such as Stand Your Ground, the Stand Your Ground Act that, you know, famously was used in Florida in the George Zimmerman case, or the Voter ID Act, which required voters to have registered and show IDs in certain states that adopted it, as well as their Anti-Net Neutrality Act called the Resolution on Network Neutrality, which actually served to gut net neutrality and to make it very unneutral. But yeah, the main function of the Right to Work law, which many in the labor movement have dubbed the Right to Work for Less law, is the prohibition of unions from requiring that all workers in unionized workplaces pay dues into those unions. So this essentially means that unions are still required to represent all workers covered under their collective bargaining agreement, even if some or all of those workers refuse to pay their fair share to fund the union for their efforts. You know, of course, the intended effect of this is to make it harder for organized labor groups to sustain themselves financially and also to undermine workers' collective bargaining power.
Yeah, and so according to the data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, this law has been shown to lower wages by an average of $111,000 per year from workers in states that implement right-to-work legislation.
And since Republicans pushed the passage of the right-to-work law in December 2012, union membership in Michigan has fallen by about 40,000 workers.
Yeah, and obviously the decline in manufacturing jobs, specifically in the auto industry, that resulted from offshoring and increased international competition had a lot to do with this, or the shrinking numbers. But it's undeniable that the adoption of this law led many workers to opt out of paying dues and had a negative effect on the perceived benefits of union membership, you know, because they had less kind of revenues to spend for workers.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you see that people are joining your workplace and then not having to pay into the union, why would you do it? Mm-hmm. And then that sort of spirals into being like, well, all right, if they're getting less funding, therefore they're able to do less, what is the benefit of it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's not the exact same, but I think, you know, people would not propose some similar situation for healthcare, right? Where some folks are paying in and then basically not having to pay their, and then other folks aren't, not paying their fair share, right, to help the people who are actually using the funds and things like that.
Yeah.
The whole point of the operation is that everyone's paying in for a greater good. And when you chop that off at the leg, you're doing exactly what the corporations are hoping to have you do, which is reduce the power.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, like, it is effectively, it nullifies the effectiveness of a union if all of the workers in that workplace do not have to be a part of it or not have to financially support it, but it still has to do all the work that it would normally do, whether everyone...
You know, and on this show in particular, we've seen a lot of really silly and funny examples of kind of corporations trying to fight union dues and kind of talk about how negative they are. But I think they are, you know, for someone who hasn't seen the benefits or doesn't understand that a lot of the benefits they have today are because of those unions, you know, it can kind of work on folks. In particular, we saw the Delta Airlines basically put up in the break room, hey, you know, your union dues could be an Xbox. Right. You know, silly kind of things like this. But, you know, unfortunately, I think if people aren't connecting the dots there, it can be pretty persuasive.
Yeah. And like, I mean, exactly as you said, like the history of what labor unions have done for working people in this country in terms of, you know, crafting the situations in which we are allowed to work, like the protections we have, that's not taught. Most people aren't aware of that unless they seek it out. And so if you come into a work environment and you're unaware of what it is that the benefit it is that are provided to you through, you know, being a part of the union and what unions in general do, then you would see that this is just money coming out of your pocket for something you don't understand.
Yeah.
And if someone puts out to you like, well, you could buy an Xbox with it, you'll likely opt for that because that's a tangible thing you understand and that you do want versus this, you know, sort of nebulous, well, the union protects me in a way that I've never experienced before.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but regardless, like after decades of attacks on workers and rollbacks of labor protections, you know, these Michigan progressives had taken a monumental first step towards evening the playing field and strengthening, you know, the beleaguered labor movement that we're discussing here. Now, you know, there's still 26 other states that currently have similar right-to-work legislation on the books. Of course, all of that did come from ALEC, the legislative exchange program, where they just brought basically the exact same legislation to all those 26 states that Michigan got, filled in the blanks, and then put it on the books. You know, but once Governor Whitmer in Michigan signs the bill, as it seems like she's intending to do, Michigan will be the first state to roll back right-to-work laws in almost 60 years. And that's a move that is sure to inspire politicians and labor advocates in those other 26 states to take action similar to what the progressives in Michigan have done.
Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it also serves as a great example of kind of what can be achieved when voters come together to elect a majority labor-friendly kind of state Senate.
Absolutely.
Right. Which is, again, has been a tactic that we've seen the right use.
Yeah.
Right. I think a lot of Democrats are focused federally. Right. And so much of this stuff happens at the state level. And so it's just, you know, a great example of some awesome work being done.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and of course, it's the kind of thing that could be replicated in all those other 26 states that have right to work, as well as every other state in the country. And it's amazing that it's happening in, you know, quote unquote, the American heartland, in a state that has been a purple state at times, but also very much a red state, you know, in some elections that we've seen. And so this is a pretty positive example.
And a state, I think, that has a lot of industry that has in the past been pillars of kind of workers' rights and advocacy and things like this, right? I don't think, you know, we've talked a lot about a ton of industries and different things like this, but in particular, Michigan is full of the types of industries that I think people categorize and think about unions with.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, if you imagine, like, what the classic union worker...
Yeah, you're not thinking about the Bay. You're not thinking about Silicon Valley, right?
Yeah.
These sorts of things.
You're not thinking of, like, an SEIU worker. You're thinking of, like, an auto worker, or something like that. Like,
and again, whose a lot of jobs have gone elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I think that has a lot to do with why it was so easy initially to pass right to work in Michigan, because the workforce there had just seen what, you know, NAFTA and things like that had done to gut their specific working environment. So much of car manufacturing went to Mexico and elsewhere that those workers were primed for anything, you know, any type of change they thought might benefit them. Even if it was just their being sold.
Or a couple dollars in their pocket, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. You know, and so, like, the impact of this decision is already reverberating around the country as, you know, is the hope for what this could provide. You've already seen people talking about, like, labor activists talking about doing the same in these other states that have it, as well as just sort of a general excitement about what it is that Michigan was able to do after a decade plus of just increasing right to work push, you know, a push for right to work in all the states around the country as well as federally. We're finally seeing the first pushback against it and rolling it back. And, you know, as former state rep, Kentucky state rep and progressive champion Charles Booker said in a statement that he released right after Michigan repealed this, it passed the Senate, quote, "Michigan is now on its way to becoming the first state to repeal right to work legislation in nearly 60 years. Let's make sure they aren't the last." Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a great sentiment. You know, obviously it's going to take a lot in some of the states that maybe aren't as full of, you know, elected progressives as Michigan is, but it is definitely possible, and they are showing, they're creating a template for what other states can do to push back against these anti-worker legislations.
Yeah. No, and I mean, I think, you know, when you look at it on its face, it's definitely a hard thing to combat because, you know, you combine it with the name, yeah, right? Like the kind of confusing right to work name and things like this. Events like this help to get the word out of kind of what these bills actually do and what they mean for the worker and things like that. So I think the press is really important in addition to obviously it being a great piece of legislation.
I think it's a really good point you brought up that like the name can be really confusing because, you know, obviously right to work seems like a good thing.
If you're
a
worker. Who would oppose that? Right. You seem silly opposing it.
Yeah. Like, why would you not want the right to work? You know, but like, that's kind of the hallmark of that ALEC, of the American Legislative Exchange Council, is creating pieces of like pro-corporate legislation that have very populist language. And I think the best example is Citizens United.
Yeah.
You know, a phrase that seems so perfectly suited for like the American mystique and everything. You know, we are individuals, we're citizens of this country, we're united in what, you know, but it's actually just a piece of legislation making it so that the individual voter has less say in the system because money from corporations can flood the system. So yeah, it's a great sort of like bit of newspeak, you know, or something like that. You know, so from, you know, that's a very positive example of something that is actually happening on the ground and will hopefully be replicated in state houses elsewhere. Now, you know, from the Michigan State House, we're going to look now instead to Washington, D.C., the federal capital, where nearly 200 Democrats and independents in Congress, led by chair of the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, Senator Bernie Sanders, have co-sponsored the reintroduction of the PRO Act into the new congressional session.
Mm-hmm. And obviously the PRO Act is something that we've discussed numerous times on the show. And essentially it would rewrite kind of a ton of America's broken labor laws and has generally been held as one of the most crucial pieces of legislation for the labor movement in the modern era of union busting.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so it's called the PRO Act, but it is technically called the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, or PRO, PRO. Which has been organized labor's top priority in Congress since it was first introduced in 2019. And it's aimed at making it easier for workers to unionize and to obtain a first collective bargaining agreement. So, you know, more specifically, the PRO Act would require all employers to post notices explaining that workers have the right to form a union.
It would ban employers from requiring workers to attend anti-union captive audience meetings, which we've talked about before.
Absolutely, yeah. It would also impose penalties for the first time ever on employers who illegally fire workers for supporting a union, which could cost them up to $100,000 per violation.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we saw that kind of at a higher level with the Starbucks kind of in the Pacific Northwest. I think that's a great example of it.
Absolutely.
Recently. It would also stipulate that gig contract workers like Uber and Lyft drivers are employees, allowing them to access the same labor and organizing rights as other workers.
Yeah.
Right. Because that's obviously a huge topic we've discussed on the show.
Yeah. And it is a topic that's not going away. You know, so like
it's only going to get larger.
Right. So like this, we do need a legislation that deals with that. The PRO Act would also bar employers from permanently replacing striking workers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good.
And it would make sympathy and solidarity strikes legal, as well as make it legal again for unions to boycott businesses that buy or sell scab-made products, and for workers to refuse to deliver or handle goods produced by strike-breaking workers at other companies.
Yeah. And, you know, most notably connected to the topic we were just discussing before this, the PRO Act would override states' right-to-work laws that, of course, prohibit union contracts from requiring all represented workers from sharing the cost of that representation. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Labor Radio here on listener-supported KBOO Community Radio. We'll get back to our discussion about some recent labor-friendly legislative developments in just a moment. But first, I want to drop a quick reminder to please consider donating to KBOO during this last week of our winter membership drive. And after the show is done, be sure to check out some of the great All Thrills, No Frills special programming that we've got over at kboo.fm/thrills. Please help us reach our $17,000 fundraising goal by donating today at kboo.fm/give. We thank you so much for supporting community-powered radio. And now back to our discussion about these positive legislative developments within the labor movement. So we have been discussing the PRO Act and its reintroduction into Congress by some 200 Democrats and Independents. So this reintroduction of this principal piece of labor legislation comes at a moment where workers and the American public more broadly appear to have a large appetite for organized labor activity. In recent years, there has been a flurry of union activity in the service industry at companies such as Starbucks, in the delivery and logistics industries at companies like Amazon, within the institutions of higher learning, as well as, you know, within the healthcare sector and many others, including some of the tech and, you know, writing sectors that are more based online based.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And over the last 2 years, union petition filings grew by 53%. The number of work stoppages rose by 52% in 2022 specifically. And according to Gallup polling, public approval for unions hit a 60-year high in 2022 as well. So the tide is turning in terms of how people are viewing unions and the actions they're taking actively.
A 60-year high, that's amazing. You know, however, of course, you know, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, though the sheer number of U.S. workers in unions grew in 2022, the proportion of workers that are in unions shrank to merely 10.1%, which is the lowest rate ever recorded in this country. So in light of that, labor advocates point to this discrepancy as evidence that our current labor laws are holding back the potential for increasing union membership. And in fact, actually, in a statement released after the PRO Act was reintroduced, Senator Sanders said, quote, "If we are going to reverse the 40-year decline of the middle class, reduce the widening gap between the billionaire class and everyone else, and take on the unprecedented level of corporate greed in America, we have to rebuild the trade union movement. This is what the PRO Act is all about." End quote. Mm-hmm. You know, so yeah, finally, we are going to keep our focus here in Washington, D.C., and actually within the U.S. Senate, where Bernie Sanders' colleague and Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey recently introduced a pair of bills that aim to tweak tax laws in order to chip away at one of the major advantages employers hold in union campaigns and disputes. The first bill that has been introduced by Senator Casey is titled the No Tax Breaks for Union Busting Act. And that would bar companies from writing off union busting expenses as business expenses on their taxes. It would also end taxpayer subsidization of union busting, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and economists have estimated that employers spend about $340 million yearly on union busting efforts, often hiring expensive anti-union lawyers and consultants, which we've talked about on the show. But they're able to simply write these expenses off the same way they can write off things like employee health benefits. And like you mentioned, pass those expenses off onto the taxpayer, essentially kind of politicizing and making people partake in it when maybe they don't believe in such actions.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, there are like entire law firms that are devoted to basically being, you know, legal experts and consultants for these companies that charge top dollar, and these companies will pay that and bring them in and then write it off as a tax write-off.
Yeah, and we've talked about it, you know, a bunch of times before, but in addition to legislation, a lot of who is sitting kind of in that executive branch leadership position and is appointing folks across the board is also really important, right? Because, you know, we've talked about on the show, Biden's administration is actively pursuing companies breaking kind of existing laws, whereas the Trump administration was basically letting whatever happened happened. So, I mean, this is an even great, you know, obviously we're really focused on legislation today, but kind of there are more pieces than just that. And so this is kind of a more clear cut, black and white, penalize or reduce the kind of effectiveness of doing these things. And it's not really kind of a board or anything like that.
And it's definitely, it's great because it is attacking it from a different angle than what most, you know, labor, what most gains on the labor side come from. They usually come from trying to change labor law and stuff like that. This is changing tax law, which
also I think is very interesting because it's kind of attacking corporations where they see the kind of why they don't like unions, right?
Yeah.
They see it as an increased expense when really we've talked about on the show again that when you actually work together with your workers, you typically come out with an outcome that is kind of more efficient.
Yeah.
But again, that would take time and money. And so making the fighting unions more expensive could also tilt some companies in other directions.
Yeah. I mean, they see the short-term benefit of just paying a lot up front to not have to pay these extra labor costs and not the long-term benefit of having a satisfied workforce that stays with you longer. Things like that.
And becomes more effective. Yeah.
Exactly. Now, the second bill that Senator Casey has introduced is titled the Tax Fairness and Workers Act, and that would restore union members' ability to deduct union dues from their taxes, a benefit that Republicans nixed in their 2017 tax overhaul. The bill would allow union members to subtract dues from their gross incomes, allowing workers to receive the tax benefit regardless of whether or not they itemize their taxes.
Yeah, it also contained other benefits for workers that mirror tax boons already provided to businesses, like writing off travel costs and business expenses. This would restore yet another benefit axed by the Republicans' Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
Yeah. So in a statement released accompanying the introduction of these two bills, Senator Casey said, quote, "For too long, the deck in Washington has been stacked against workers. My bills will use the tax code to help level the playing field for workers and empower them to exercise their right to organize. There are common sense steps to restore fairness to our nation's tax code and to stop rewarding companies or corporations' bad behavior when taking advantage of hardworking Americans and their families," end quote. Both of these bills have the support of fellow Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, as well as several labor unions like the AFL-CIO, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the American Federation of Teachers, and the Service Employees International Union. And labor advocates have long criticized the country's labor laws for being unfairly skewed to favor employers and management. And in fact, labor laws are so weak that it's often more lucrative for employers to break the law and face the penalties than it is for them to act lawfully.
Mm-hmm. The EPI, the Economic Policy Institute, has found that employers are charged with breaking labor laws in 4 in 10 union election cases.
Yikes.
And that's only counting cases where employees got to the point of filing for a union. So there are plenty more that basically never made it to that stage. And at the same time, many employers find it more financially expedient to spend millions of dollars busting the union than to allow their workers to exercise their collective rights, which, you know, we touched on.
It's just that short-term thinking of like, well, we're going to spend a lot up front, even though, you know, to avoid this increased cost without ever considering what the long-term benefit of allowing the union to flourish and working with them as a partner. Mm-hmm.
Especially when, you know, unions play in so many highly specific trade skill situations, right? Where kind of institutional knowledge and kind of skills that grow over time are so incredibly valuable, especially in a space like teaching.
Oh, yeah.
And so it just can be a very interesting combination of factors where you're pushing folks out, burning people out.
Yeah.
In really areas where they need to be there for a long time to show value.
Yeah, you need to have that institutional knowledge. You have to have those workers who grow with the job and really gain a base of knowledge they can pass on to the next generation. And if you just have high turnover because workers can't stay in those jobs because they don't pay enough, then you're never going to be able to develop the strong workforce that you need to have those jobs. Yeah, so, you know, these are some incredible developments, and we will obviously keep tracking them for you, our listeners. We unfortunately are running out of time here. So just to close things up, you know, it is unclear whether or not the new iteration of the PRO Act or either of these tax changes presented by Senator Casey will be able to pass through the Republican-controlled House. You know, but taken as a whole, the introduction of these labor-friendly bills sends a clear signal from congressional progressives to workers and to organizers on the ground that their elected officials support their efforts and stand with them in their struggle for better labor practices and workspaces. So yeah, you know, who knows? Who knows what happens from this? Hopefully the right to work starts to cascade as well, but we will have to leave it there. We will keep you abreast of this for next month if there are developments. Thank you so much for tuning into Labor Radio. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilland.
Have a great night.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO, Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
These are the final days of KBOO's Volume 2 All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign, wrapping up with a full day of live music. Saturday, March 25th, KBOO's annual Bluegrass Marathon will be held at the historic Multnomah Grange 71 in Gresham. Go to kboo.fm/bluegrass23 for ticket info. Tune in or join us in person for the 2023 Bluegrass Marathon on March 25th and get your exclusive limited edition 2023 Bluegrass Marathon t-shirt at kboo.fm/bgshirt.
Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, March 25th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. for our 2023 Bluegrass Marathon, live at Multnomah Grange 71. Uncle Chippy and Josh will kick off the marathon at 9 with a journey back to 1971, along with live recordings from local and regional acts.